From NPR Music, you're connected to All Songs Considered. I'm Bob Boylan. The Flaming Lips have been together for over 30 years, and they're putting out some of their best music now, 13 albums down the road. You'd be hard-pressed to find any band that, after so many years, still seems so inspired. On this edition of All Songs Considered, Wayne Coyne plays DJ. It's perhaps a bit more talkative than most of our DJ shows, but my co-host Robin Hilton and I talk to Wayne Coyne about remaining creative and relevant after all these years. We talk about recreating the music of others, including Pink Floyd and Dark Side of the Moon. We talk about the role of drugs in music and art, and the music Wayne Coyne chose for his mom's memorial. Wayne Coyne was at a studio in Oklahoma. Robin Hilton and I were here in Washington, D.C. We start with an early childhood memory that left an indelible stamp and continues to be influential from the late 1960s, the song Strawberry Fields Forever.
I always go back to this song by the Beatles, and I guess it's John Lennon. You think of John Lennon when you think of Strawberry Fields Forever now. And it wasn't just the song. And Beatles fanatics will remember this myth was circulating that Paul McCartney was dead. And at the end of Strawberry Fields Forever, at the time anyway, I don't know if people still think of it as saying that now, at the end of Strawberry Fields Forever, John Lennon says, "I buried Paul." And and my brothers and I would listen to this, you know, just over and over and over, you know, and somehow that music and the death of Paul McCartney, but the joy of us listening to the music and the whole strangeness of, even though Paul's dead, and, you know, there's somebody that looks like Paul McCartney, that sounds like him, that took his place right away. You know, that when you're 8 years old, that's utterly believable. And you know, it's an eerie song anyway. I mean, even when I hear it now, knowing that Paul McCartney's still alive, it's just an eerie song. But it got so ingrained in us because of this very mysterious, you know, voice at the end. And, you know, that stuff, once it gets in you, I think when you're of that age, I mean, you can't ever extract that again from, you know, this, it coloring what you think of music.
Take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real, and nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields forever. Living is easy with eyes closed. Misunderstanding.
So I think actually what John actually says on this record is probably, I think it's cranberry sauce, but it doesn't matter, right? when you're seven
well,
or eight,
see,
or 10 or...
I think the dilemma is, you know, when you do that thing with your mind where you kind of say it in your mind while they're saying it, you know, you can almost turn it into anything. And even then, you know, I don't remember exactly the millisecond when it's getting ready to play, but it always comes up and it just feels like I buried Paul. But again, hearing the end of that, it's just, what a strange, strange way to end any record made by any weirdo ever in the world. And here it is, it's the Beatles, one of the biggest bands ever in the world. And that's a hit song, I suppose, you know. I mean, everybody knows this track, mm-hmm. and yet it fades out with backwards loops, probably from the BBC library there, and out-of-tune guitars and clumsily played drums and everything. It's just utterly amazing.
Can you think of where you were at the moment, you and your brother?
That's the funny thing about this cloud of memories around music back then. But I think it's connected a little bit with me, with the death of Robert Kennedy. I don't remember all the events of the death of Robert Kennedy, but when Robert Kennedy, it wasn't like he was dead right away. You know, it was a little bit of a couple of days or something. And it was powerful. I mean, it's not a sad in the sense because you don't know the person or whatever, but there's this strange, very powerful thing that everybody is involved with. And then this music that really seemed like everybody in the whole world knew it. I mean, unlike music now where, you know, I can really be listening to something and love it and play it all the time. And, you know, the rest of the world could really not have any idea what it is. I mean, for us back then, it almost seemed like we were all listening to the same music at the same time.
The idea that there were probably 100 songs all year that came out that you spent time with would be a lot. It's probably more like 30.
Maybe even less than that. When you're young, you're lucky that time has slowed down for you because everything you do is some new crazy experience, you know? Mm-hmm. And so this idea that this Beatles song is connected with death and all that, I think that's just seared into me. And even though I hear it now and I understand the little bit of music and production and songwriting and all these things now in my later life, it still, you know, it does that thing that music does so well. I mean, you know, your memory, it sometimes works where you remember this little piece here and then, you know, an hour later you remember that and maybe tomorrow you'll remember something else. But sometimes with the aid of music, it goes, you know, right to the thing.
Wayne, it's interesting that you picked Strawberry Fields Forever because I actually was listening to the new Lips record. It's called The Terror. I was listening to it last night. And the opening cut made me think of Strawberry Fields Forever in just the tiniest way. And it's in the percussion. With the song Look, the Sun is Rising, that's the opening cut to your new record. Mm-hmm. I thought, I love how the beat comes in. It's just a little bit off. It could have just, and I thought, you know, they could have done just a straight up beat with this song, started right on the one, and it would have been fine. But I love how it's just a little off. And I thought about that Strawberry Fields because the beginning of that song is the same way. I thought, you know, Ringo could have just come in on the one, done a straight beat, and it would have been fine. But he shifts everything and, you know, does it on some of the off beats. Can we just listen to a little bit of Look, the Sun is Rising and
All right.
hear what I'm talking about?
That's cool. Thanks. Yeah.
I love this track. I love the record so much. I've been spending a lot of time with it. Are there a lot of drum machines on this? Or what am I hearing here? What are we hearing?
Well, you know, with the way that recording and computers and all this stuff has gone these days, you know, it's hard for us to remember. I mean, I know that first track has, you know, I think it begins with some sort of computer-driven you know, mm-hmm. timekeeper sound over there. And that's definitely, and I when I say definitely, it's because we like that it is like a single take of just some drums. I believe it's probably even just one microphone. But I like how you picked up some of those little nuances. Sometimes I don't think about those things with music, you know, that it comes in, you know, before the beats and stuff like that. I just hear it and think, oh, that's cool. But yeah. But you're right. I mean, there's some elements in that that just simply... if you know too much about music, you scratch your head and kind of go, now why are they doing that? Because some of these things they're not quite in tune, and we're aware of that. I think that's part of the quality of it, or the unsettled, you know, quality of it that we like.
Well, in fact, I think if you know too much about music, then you probably also might not make that kind of music, right? Because rules are rules. When rules get ingrained in you, most people tend to follow them.
Well, I think that's the somewhere along the way. I don't know if I understand this, but I think that's what the Zen people talk about, is, you know, what good is the world without, you know, your curiosity and finding out things? But there seems to be some caution of like, now don't ruin it for yourself, you know. I always tell the story of these little kids that would come around my house at Halloween, and sometimes we spend like a whole couple days before Halloween getting the porch or something ready with, you know, a dead guy with his guts carved out, and we put spaghetti or something in there. And the little kids from around the neighborhood that don't have anything better to do will see me, and they'll say, hey, you're setting this thing up. We set it up together, and we know it's all fake blood, and I've got, of course, the Flaming Lips have a lot of good strobe lights and sound effect things. I set all this up on the porch, and they know that it's all exactly a very contrived moment, really just to scare little kids, them included.
Yeah.
But though they've seen it set up, when they show up in costume on Halloween night, it still scares them. I mean, you know, and I want to be like that. You know, I want to know how things work, and yet I still want to get, you know, the great, amazing experience. So that's hard to do. And so I think, sometimes we there's things we like about music, but like you said, when you know too much, you go, oh, well, it goes this way and goes that way. But, you know, music is not like, it doesn't have to be like spelling words. You know, mm-hmm. You can kind of do whatever you want with it, and it can express whatever you want. And that's not right or wrong. That's whatever you want.
But you find that musicians often get it. Patterns. You're one of the rare breeds, 30 years of making music to most people's awareness anyway, of being able to constantly still shift and find stuff and be on an adventure. How do you do that? I mean, that's hard.
Well, thank you.
Don't.
I mean, that's a great, great thing to say. Well, I think when we say that, you know, I can freely say that I don't understand music, but, you know, a couple of the guys in the group and our producer, Dave Friedman, I mean, you know, Steven, the other, you know, songwriter and main creative force in the group, he's probably, if we could measure it, on the level of a Miles Davis or a Stravinsky type of musician. So there's an element of the Flaming Lips that we all think of as very kind of punk rock, you know. I think there's a lot of things that I do, maybe I gave too much away saying I set up my own little Halloween scene on my porch, you know. But I like to do things myself. I like to explore things myself. But I'm not, you know, a very good musician. And to make, you know, emotional music, I think you could stumble upon it here and there. But I think to consistently make emotional music, you really do have to know how some of these equations work, so you can build these dimensions of how emotion works. We write songs a lot that are simple, that are effective, but even some of this music that we just heard, there are layers in there that are kind of, you know, you wouldn't stumble upon them just in a primitive kind of fumbling on the keyboard. It really, some of it is very complex, but I think that's the real beauty, is they've kind of let, what's the analogy of the, you know, the patients are in charge of the insane asylum. You know, I'm the person with the least amount of, you know, control and ability, and yet I've got at my command, but certainly people helping me, doing my thing, people that know utterly, you know, everything and are able to do, you know, virtually anything that we want. So that's probably why this continuation of being driven and creating and, being lucky enough to create things that people like once in a while as well, is there. I mean, I absolutely, absolutely get up every day and think, man, let's make some cool music.
That's so great. And I'm looking at the list of things you have put together for us, Dave, as Wayne Coyne, as you play DJ here at All Songs Considered. And I guess one of the ones where you really have to know would be the Thunderball, right? I mean, you can't just have written that and not know the music.
Well, yeah, I mean, I put Tom Jones's Thunderball. It's a song from one of the James Bond movies, maybe one of the first ones. The reason I put that on there is because oftentimes I think, and not that I do lots and lots of lists, but I do enough lists that I, you know, get to pick things that I really like as opposed to things that may make me look really cool. But I try to always mention how much this drama and I mean that particular song that Tom Jones does. I mean, it's an amazing, amazing, amazing piece of dramatic, freaky music that you wouldn't be able to play. I wouldn't be able to play it just as a sort of inspired punk rock psychedelic musician. You know, I just could never figure it out. But I think that's what's the great thing that's happened to the way I'm able to make music. This music that goes so far back into your mind, you know, talking about the Beatles when I was 8 years old, this stuff goes so far back into your mind that it is what your music kind of is informed by. It doesn't mean that you're creating music because you heard it in the past. It just is informed by these things. And it would be very frustrating, I think, for me if I wanted to make music like that and really had no faculties that could allow me to get there. But luckily for me, through Steven and the group and Dave Fridman and a lot of, you know, people willing to keep trying and not worrying about, you know, messing it up, we really do sometimes get to these areas where it's like, wow, that is just, it's amazing what music can do.
Let me go ahead and play a bit of the Tom Jones for those who've never heard it. And I warn all of those that just, like, hold on to your chair real tight as we play the song. Here we go.
Runs while others walk. He acts while other men just talk. He looks at this world and wants it all. So he strikes like thunderbolt. He knows the meaning of success. His needs are more, so he gives less.
There's legend about, it's really unbelievable. There is legend about that song, and Tom Jones sang that song, and the last note, which is this awesome long note, Tom Jones fainted in the studio, just like he blacked out when he sang that
right,
song.
Right? Yeah. And it, you know, it's probably not true, but
is true.
Want it to be.
It's true for me.
It's
my universe, and I'm living.
Yeah. No, I agree. It
really
it's
is Bob's universe. You don't know how much that's true.
But I mean, there's just nothing subtle about that. You know, there was this beautiful thing that my older brothers and sister imparted to me. They didn't know they were doing it, but you know, we just loved music and we didn't really care about this idea of cultural impact and all that. You know, the people they ask me about that all the time. It's like, how could you like something like Tom Jones when there were things like, you know, the Jefferson Airplane and the Beatles were around? And I was like, well, we liked all of it. I mean, why just have that and not have that?
And part of the answer to that too for people is that when you turn on the radio, the AM radio in those days, all of that was there. So you'd hear Tom Jones, and you'd hear Jefferson Airplane, you'd hear that within the same hour on the very same radio station. It's just what was. I mean, there were very few gatekeepers, and those gatekeepers were in control of, and this is a good thing. I'm not saying this is negative or positive. It just is. AM radio controlled what everybody heard in 1967. There wasn't FM radio, really, to be spoken of until that year, and that's all there was. And so there was a handful of people that chose everything. It was on the air, and it was all over the map. It was for your mother. It was for the kids. It was for everybody. You know, it was awesome.
Well, and my mother absolutely loved Tom Jones, so that probably had some influence on it as well, you know, so she would play the records. When she died about 10 years ago now, at her funeral, my brothers and sisters allowed me to be the one that said, why don't you put together the music for this? Obviously, they knew there was going to be a couple of Tom Jones songs playing at this post-funeral thing, you know. When I originally went to put the music together, I went to a CD and got a couple of songs, but it didn't work for me because I got so used to hearing the scratched up records. and you know, it's phenomenal that is how much, you know, scratching you can put on a Tom Jones record when you're 8 years old, you know, and still act like it's playable. The scratches became so much a part of the sound that I didn't enjoy the ones that didn't have it. And literally what we played at the post-ceremony thing there, it was put onto a CD, but it was put on with the scratches and all that. And, you know, that part of it to me, it's not just a song, it's not just a singer, it is the sound. And, you know, you take away the... and it became a different song. So, yeah. But again, it's like that idea that that song doesn't have any, we don't build. I guess it builds to him passing out at the end. You're right. That's the only that's the only place
logical
it should go.
Logical conclusion. Yeah.
The song is so overwhelming that it makes Tom Jones pass out. Yeah.
when you've done In the Court of a Crimson King, which I've never heard, which I need to, you as a band have done recreated Dark Side of the Moon, which I'd like to play a little bit of.
Sure, yeah.
You would call yourself the non-musicians of the musicians in your band. Would that be fair to say, having this conversation?
There's a few of us, yeah. I mean, there's three that are, you know, mega musicians, and two that are just, you know, we're in here having fun, yeah.
So how do you even begin to tackle it? But maybe more importantly, what do you take away from it, learning about Pink Floyd, from learning about their songwriting or their playing? What do you gain as a musician from that?
Well, stuff? I mean, every time, I mean, if you're lucky, you go in, and we don't do it for these reasons. You do it because you just are curious about a song or you just love a song. I mean, with the Dark Side of the Moon stuff, you know, you can't help but be around musicians and to be curious. I mean, the Dark Side of the Moon by Pink Floyd, it gets sort of dismissed, I think, sometimes because, well, it's just so popular and, you know, popular music can't be any good. Well, I would say those people who dismiss it they're just wrong. I mean, reason it's so popular is because it is so good and it's so perfect. It doesn't mean other records aren't just as good, but it is a great, great, undeniably great record. It's a great series of songs, great sounds, great things that they say in the lyrics, and what it's worth for what Pink Floyd even meant at the time as a group. So it has all that going for it. So anybody that dismisses it, they don't know what they're talking about.
Also, but Pink Floyd at the time of that record did not sell a whole lot of records.
Exactly.
Might add.
Yeah, they were the
underground weirdo band. And, you know,
exactly. So, yeah. So anybody that says that, that dismisses it, I'm like, you don't know. But all that being said, you can't be a group for very long before, if you're around musicians who just want to say, what's going on there? How are they doing that? Why would they do that? You know, and you just start to mess around with it. So we had, I forget, we were playing a show where we did a couple of these songs from Dark Side of the Moon, which are complicated songs. I mean, not a lot of groups could play them easily. I mean, it wasn't easy for us, but to do the arranging and to do the dynamics and all that. And then when we put out our previous record, there are these producers, and I say this in all, I like it all, but it is sometimes demanding, producers at iTunes that will ask you for more things. You know, we're getting ready to put out a record. Could you come up with maybe 8 more tracks that we could put out as an exclusive thing? And a lot of artists, I suppose, will say yes. And I kind of begrudgingly said, well, we don't really have any extra tracks. I mean, I'm more than willing to give people anything that we have, but we didn't really have anything. And I flippantly suggested, well, why don't we just do a cover version of Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon? And that was met with a little bit of like, But the very next day, they came back and said, well, we think this would be a great idea, and we'll send one of our producers out. And we had, I don't know what it was, we only had like a day or two to put together the whole thing.
That's insane. I'm sorry.
Well, luckily, luckily, Stephen had already put together what we thought would really be the hardest track to get our heads around, which is the song Money. You know, it's the bluesiest one. It's the most popular one. And it was, frankly, one that we didn't really think that much about. But he had done this kind of... I don't mean it to sound like hip-hop, but it has these kind of big boom, boom beats to it and stuff. And... for whatever the reason at the time, because it's talking about money and stuff, it could give the impression we're talking about, you know, bling and all that. So we thought, hey, look at that. That's a new take on that. And then we easily went in and did some of the other tracks, which we really, really love anyway, did kind of our take on it, which isn't that difficult. I think it would be too boring, too painstaking, and really not very interesting to do it just like Pink Floyd anyway. I mean, some of the things that they did back in, what would it be, 72 or 73, you could easily do on an iPad. You know, we could do it right now sitting in front of us. Sounds, echoes, all these types of textures that were, you know, very difficult, almost impossible to know what they would even sound like without a lot of trying like they did back then. So we never wanted to remake it. We just thought, well, we'll redo it in our way. And people who really love Pink Floyd, some of them will really love it, but some of them really hated it.
So what did you walk away with having done it? I mean, to get inside of it at all in terms of, I mean, these are songs you've heard, but you must have walked away with something different having sung it, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, like we talked about even with the track of ours that you played, you know, you get an impression of what the music is, and sometimes, you know, it's coming at you kind of like a cloud, and it doesn't really matter if it's, you know, a Rhodes playing this part or a electric guitar playing that or what it is. But when you get in there and you really listen, sometimes it's kind of uncanny what they do. You know, it's clumsy. This music speeds up, it slows down. Great bands all the time play wrong notes. Mm-hmm. It's very liberating, you know, because that's what groups think, oh, I don't play very well. I'm like, they don't always play all that well, and it's better for it, you know.
Let's hear a little. Fortunate enough to see Dark Side of the Moon performed before it was called Dark Side of the Moon. It was called a Eclipse, a piece for a Sword of Lunatics in 72 here in Washington. I just recounted that because it was 30th anniversary just recently.
And 40th just remember, anniversary.
I'm sorry, yes, for the 40th. Thank you. Yes, it's like your guys are 30 years, but they're 40 on just Dark Side of the Moon alone. Yeah.
Well, that's amazing.
Mind-boggling piece to hear for the first time, having never heard it on record, having no idea they were going to perform it, to hear this quadraphonic sound, which was, you know, sound all over, which we more or less take for granted now because of movies, but back then was revolutionary.
Yeah.
They just did so many things that were so astonishing.
They did, and even the way that their group formed, and you know, to think that the leader in the beginning, you know, Syd Barrett, he's the star, he's the songwriter, he's what the group is about. To think after the first record, maybe a moment on the second record, he leaves, and they say, well, what do we do now? And then they go on and become this. I mean, I mean, that's a great, great thing to know. I mean, with groups all the time, they form and something happens and, you know, the dude leaves or whatever. And I tell groups all the time, it's like, don't you know, if you want to do music, just find a way, do your thing. It doesn't have to all stay. It's either these guys or nothing, or it's either this or nothing. It's like, let it happen. It's not that big of a deal.
I think of Pink Floyd a lot when I listen to the Flaming Lips. It's easy to hear some of the influences. One of the things that's similar between The Dark Side of the Moon and the new record, The Terror, is how all the songs run together, and there are lots of these hidden messages and themes going on in all of the tracks. And there's a cut that I keep going back to. It's a pretty epic one. It's about 13 minutes long or so, called You Lust, from the new record. And I just want to play a little section about 7.5 minutes into it, all right?
Okay.
Wayne, is that you saying that line there?
Well, it ends up, we have, it's me and Sarah from the group Fantagram, and we're saying, lust to succeed with, for me anyway, with a little bit of like an Asian accent.
So are you saying lust to succeed or last?
Lust to succeed. Yeah, it was Sarah and I, the other singer, we had a conversation where one of us talked about that term and how we were forgiving each other for trying to, you know, be successful with our music, as artistic and as weird as it was. You know, we would say, but we still want to be able to make a living, have people like it. And I remember us sort of saying, you know, we're not lusting to succeed.
Right. But at the same time, I felt like this was one of those lines that the more I repeated it in my head, the more confusing it got. So you could also, it could also be speaking, I thought, to the longevity of the band. And we were talking earlier about how you've managed to hold on to your sense of curiosity and while you've continued to make music over the years. And it's sort of that lusting for knowledge and lusting for just things that sort of blow your mind and keep you curious.
Well, I like that. I mean, I think you've given me way too much.
Should we just decide that's what it is?
I mean, I always like it when what we do and what we say, it really has some great, great meaning like that. but, you know.
Well, it could be read many ways, and that was the reason why it really stuck with me as I listened to the
record. No, I agree. I totally agree. I think that's the nature of why, you know, impressionistic music works so well. I mean, there was a little break in the music there where it kind of goes from a bigger rhythm falling down to a smaller one. You can hear this. And this is no exaggeration. We were mixing in the A studio. We were playing in a B studio where not everything was all set up yet. This is Dave Fridman's studio.
Which is called...
I think it's the name of the road that it's on is Tarbox.
Oh, Tarbox Road.
Yeah. And so it's Tarbox Road Studios. But we're all playing together, not really playing what you heard there. What you heard there is just a snippet of something that we played. But the main theme of this is boom, da-da-dang. And I was liking it so much, but we weren't ready to record it. And I recorded it on my iPhone. But what also you hear is me sort of moving it around, because I'm also making a video what everybody's playing. Like, you're playing that, I'm playing this. And you can hear this little phase difference as the phone you know, is moving moving around the room. But we use this little snippet from my phone in the song. I mean, and it, you know, sometimes we already know that we're not going to re-record this. We want it to sound like this. And in, I don't say lesser hands. This is really just a matter of taste and whatever it is that you want to hear or want to work on. But we already knew that hearing it on the phone was what we like. We had never considered that we would replay it and make it sound better or make it sound more in time. I mean, some of it just doesn't even stay in time with itself. And I think earlier, maybe 10 years earlier, we would have not done that. We'd have said, well, it doesn't really work. Let's make it work or whatever. And part of what we are able to do now with music is to say, it's so easy to make it perfect. Anybody can make it perfect. And perfect is the enemy of almost anything good in the world. Nothing. We really don't want things to be perfect. And listening to groups like the Beatles and even the Tom Jones, you know, they tried very hard to make it as good as they could, knowing it was never going to be perfect because it's a bunch of people playing and sounds are weird and it's a dynamic thing. To whereas nowadays, you know,
really
through with computers and all that, you can really go endlessly into detail, detail, detail. So we sometimes veer the completely opposite end of that and say, this is the detail. It's kind of, it sounds like this.
We've talked about, we're going to put Tom Jones aside for a minute. We've talked about the Beatles and Pink Floyd and you guys. And there's sort of this undeniable underpinning to all of this. I'm just going to ask this, which is the role of drugs in music. I mean, it's such a, it was such a defining force in the middle, late 60s when the Beatles did their music. And certainly Pink Floyd got their start around that time too. You have thoughts about that?
Well, in the big picture, I see why artists, musicians, weirdos, and drugs all go together, because you could see where it's just people willing to try things. Mm-hmm. You know, it isn't that it's about drugs. It's really about a kind of more intense way of living. And, you know, all things are considered. All things are allowed, you know. I mean,
taking chances, doing, letting go.
Yeah. But the risks are also on yourself, you know, to say, I'm willing to experiment with myself and see what happens. And I think that's the great lesson. There certainly were drugs and music. All that is all, it's always been connected, probably from the beginning of time, really. And even when we talk about jazz musicians and all that, it's all connected in there. But I think to so much connect, and it wasn't, I don't even think it's necessarily all drugs. I think it's LSD connected to this, not just the Beatles music, but a lot of music from the late 60s. That to me is where I really see the connection of people saying, I'm willing to say, I don't really know what this world is all about, and I'm willing to take a chance and learn new things about it. And of course, some drugs, and I speak about it as much as I can, you know, the things like crystal meth and heroin. These drugs are too powerful. Mm-hmm. And almost, you know, anybody that messes with them will struggle with it. You know, I think there's probably elements of them that will never be helpful to society or anything. But there's a lot of other drugs that taken, you know, with responsible people who are curious about themselves, are curious about intense experiences, not just with music, not just with art, just in life. I think can be fun.
Awesome. Why don't you pick us another tune?
Well, one of the songs that I've become obsessed with is this this track off of, I think it's a new album by this band called Beach House, and the song I've picked is called Myth. And when I view myself from outer space, that's a term I use, fellas. I'm drawn to this music where it's just mysterious to me. I'm really not sure what she's saying. And I've met the singer, Victoria. I've met her, and we've talked about what the words are. And she'll blatantly sort of admit, it's like, I don't know. You know, I kind of sing them while I'm playing them, and they sound good to me, and yet they are words, and if they probably do make some sense. She freely admitted it wasn't a concrete set of meanings that it would be. And I love that about this song. And I think that's what all this music kind of says, is in some sense it's saying, I don't know, but I'm willing to try and find out. And I hear that in there. You know, there's a longing. It's not complaining. You know, it's longing, saying, what is this? Yeah.
Let's hear it.
Thank you.
so beautiful. Beach House, song's called Myth. It's from their Bloom record. Came out last year. The remaining few minutes we have left, this record, the new record, is such a shift for you all. I'm just wondering, like, paint me the picture of the studio, being at Tarbox Road Studios, what you had in mind, what was going on, how things formed, and as best you can, paint that picture of making this record.
There's always a little bit of these, you know, you told the story of Tom Jones passing out. you always think when people are making records, there must be this, the atmosphere and the music must have something to do with each other. But, you know, the more and more that we record, you know, for good or for bad, we have this very busy life where you sort of have to say, we're recording today and we're going to make this work. And it isn't people sitting around dreaming. We go in and we do this thing. And if you were there, you could look around and sometimes see four people sitting on computers and wondering, what's going on here? You know, and there would be moments where people are playing music and then they would retreat back to their computers and things would happen. And it's not, I mean, you know, that's the way music has become for us anyway. It's not performance-based music. We play things and we manipulate it. We make it whatever we want, kind of like a painting or something. But it really, I mean, we've made records for so long that we don't really require that it be anywhere, that it doesn't matter what if the sun is shining, if there's, you know, if it's winter or summer. I think we're lucky that we can go so internal to this mechanism that's, you know, part of it's imagination, part of it is just subconscious intuition or whatever, and it doesn't really matter. I think that's, for better or for worse, let's hope that can work for us. It doesn't always. Sometimes you want there to be the outside world is, you know, triggering the inside world. But a lot of times for us, it's not, you know.
Is it less precious now than, like, you think about the first 3, 4, 5 records that you made? Is would that be a characteristic you throw onto making records now? That you know you probably do another and, you know, you can try this here.
Right. I think that's really the great secret to all powerful art. It's the less you feel like it matters, you almost are free to say anything. I mean, if we sometimes we look at the history of music that groups have made, I try to remind people that, you know, the Rolling Stones were finished making their record, and then at the last minute they did I Can't Get No Satisfaction as just a throwaway.
Yeah. We all wish we had those throwaways.
Yeah.
This is awesome. Thanks so much for spending time with us today. You want to pick a cut we go out on from the new record?
Sure, there's a song called Try to Explain. That is, it's very, you know, it's strange, powerful, sad song. But I don't want people to think it's because we were sad. I mean, we are emotional people who like emotional music. And yeah, it's great to create things that move even the people that make it.
Thanks for spending time with us. It's really great talking to you.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Yeah, you got a cool show. It is. It's great.
Well, you got a cool band.
Thank you.
And thanks for the record. Really enjoying it.
Yeah, indeed.
Excellent. Well, thank you for saying that. Thank you.
Cheers. Wayne Coyne of the Flaming Lips. The new record is called The Terror, and you can hear the whole thing during the week of April 8th as part of NPR Music's First Listen series. I'm Bob Boylan, along with Robin Hilton for NPR Music. It's All Songs Considered.
Thank you. They were me.